Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This album turned on the studio sheen and turned off some potential fans. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Today on the show, we're revisiting two of our favorite segments from earlier this year. In a little while, you'll hear an in-studio performance from singer-songwriter Todd Snyder. But back in April, the Library of Congress announced its latest batch of recordings set for official preservation. And on the list was this 1977 album by Steely Dan called Asia. It's a pretty controversial record. See, on one hand, Asia was a commercially successful piece of jazz pop. On the other hand, it was a commercially successful piece of jazz pop. We're going to revisit that discussion, but don't you dare try to call in. We're not live today. Just sit back and listen to what happened when we asked, is Asia smooth sailing or Dan overboard? It was the perfect question for a
Soundcheck Smackdown.
And joining me on the line from Florida is Eric Deggans, former pop music critic and current TV and media critic for the St. Petersburg Times. Eric, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I feel like a champion already.
And joining us by phone from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, is the author and music critic Alex V. Cook. Alex, hope you got your gloves on. Welcome to Soundcheck.
I'm ready. This isn't the first SmackDown I've had over Steely Dan, so
okay.
I'm ready for it.
Do tell. First, let me get to our question here. Eric,
yes.
Steely Dan, Asia, smooth sailing or Dan overboard?
I love that record. It's got the coolest drum solo ever put on a pop record. And it's more than that, it's the ultimate expression of Steely Dan's melding of musicianship and pop sensibility and sort of FM 70s rock all mashed together in a bunch of really good performances and compositions.
All right, Alex, do you disagree?
I would take a different stance on this. I kind of always thought growing up, I was 8 years old when this came out, and this was part of the sort of bloated sound of the 70s that, you know, a lot of us, you know, kids suffered under. I always thought everyone hated Steely Dan until one day I mentioned at a bar when it came on. I believe Deacon Blue came on, and I just announced, you know, out of the blue, like, God, I hate Steely Dan. The room kind of went silent. And, you know, my friends who I had been discussing music with were like, what are you talking about? What are you? And even there was a burnout there in the bar standing nearby that overheard this. And he was ready to take me outside over this.
I rest my case.
So, didn't realize that I was against the world in not really loving Steely Dan.
Eric, why is it? What is the appeal? Why do people feel like they need to take Alex outside when he says he doesn't like Steely Dan?
Well, you know, what I will say about Steely Dan, especially their biggest hits, is that they have been mainstays on pop radio for close to 40 years. So I think it's easy to take something like that for granted. I mean, you know, everybody has snide jokes about Stairway to Heaven. But if you actually listen to the song and you try to remember the impact it had when it came out, then you realize that it was an amazing song for its time. And you're tired of it because you've heard it week after week on classic rock radio for 30 years. And I think Steely Dan has suffered from that, too.
But Alex was 8 years old. He hadn't heard Steely Dan for 30 years.
No, I'm saying now he's had to deal with 30 years of listening to it. And you know, I think it's easy to slough off Steely Dan's later work because I don't think the compositions were as strong. And I think this point about them being a great example of 70s bloat makes sense when you talk about Gaucho or when you talk about some of the later Steely Dan records. But this record has great compositions and great performances. There aren't even really that many songs. And even the instrumentation is not really that dense. It doesn't really get out of hand until you get later into their catalog.
So you think the Library of Congress has chosen well in picking Asia out of the Steely Dan catalog?
I would say, yeah. I would say so. I mean, you know, there's a certain type. They were pioneering something that I think people kind of take for granted now. People take for granted artists like Norah Jones and the kind of the Alison Krauss and the way they cross these genres, mm-hmm. and can work in pop and can work in rock and can work in country. But, you know, that didn't necessarily happen quite so slickly and quite so well in the 70s. And Steely Dan, I think, pioneered in showing people how to do that.
You use the word slickly here, sure. And I'm going to throw this over to Alex because, you know, Alex, you're probably not, I know you're not, the only person in the world to look askance at Steely Dan and this album in particular. And one of the brickbats that's been hurled at them is that the album is too perfect, that it is slick, that it is kind of smooth, you know, kind of light pop. Or smooth rock, if there is such a thing.
Well, I would even go, you know, further than that, in that what they did in this record, and what a lot of people were doing in 1977. I looked up, you know, what were some of the other big albums of that era, just to make sure I had my dates right. And, like, you know, Fleetwood Mac's Rumors and Meatloaf's Bat Outta Hell, and, you know, even, you know, on the, I guess, the truly, you know, I guess, atrocious side of things, Sticks, The Grand Illusion, were all, you know, happening at that time.
That's another smackdown, the Sticks thing. That's another smackdown for a later week.
You know, what these people were doing, they were bringing in so much stuff. I think studio technology had evolved to this point that you really could create music in a new way. And, you know, when you listen to some of these other albums that I've mentioned, they're huge. They're, you know, monolithic monsters of records. But they have a sense that they're using that to express a greater humanity. I never get that off of this record. Always feel that when I listen to these songs that are immaculately recorded, that are immaculately performed.
And let's remember Roger Nichols, the recording engineer who worked with Steely Dan, who just died at the age of 66. So a shout out to him, because, I mean, that is one thing I think everybody agrees on, Alex, that the album is technically about as close to perfect as you can get.
But absolutely.
But go ahead.
Absolutely.
But so you find it leaves you kind of cold?
It leaves me cold. I never get the feeling, and even when they you know, pull all of the different pieces and all the different genres of things of jazz and blues and ragtime and you know, all that stuff that they grab for this record. I almost feel like, you know, it's laid out in almost surgical precision. Mm. You know, it's almost vivisected.
Well, let's. Eric, I know you want to take Alex outside and beat him up, but that's what we're here for on the Soundcheck Smackdown. But first, let's give our listeners a chance to hear what we're talking about. And listeners, what do you think about the Library of Congress's decision to induct Steely Dan's Asia? Is it possible for an album to be too perfect, or is it just the right call by the library? You can give us a call at 212-433-WNYC or leave a comment on the Soundcheck page, wnyc.org/soundcheck. This is the title track. That is Asia, spelled A-J-A, in case you're not aware of this 1977 hit record for Steely Dan. The subject of our Soundcheck Smackdown debate this week, in the wake of the album being inducted as part of this year's Library of Congress entrance into the National Recording Registry. Eric Deggans applauds the move. The former pop music critic and current TV and media critic for the St. Petersburg Times in Florida is a big fan. Alex Cook, the author, journalist, and music editor for OutsideLeft.com, is left out in the cold by Steely Dan and their studio perfection. What about our listeners? Into the control room we go. Producer Joel Meyer with some of your comments. Joel.
John, there's a lot of poetic love for this Steely Dan album on the Soundcheck page. Nick from the Upper West Side throws down the gauntlet with this. Asia is a beautiful, mature album made by men, not boys. A powerful musical accomplishment and a logical progression from their previous work. Here's what Mark from Washington, D.C. has to say. Asia is the apex of Steely Dan's studio wizardry. When you then take into account the fact that the riffs from that album have been sampled over and over and over, it seems pretty clear that it's a vital work. But Mike from New York City is not so sure. He writes, I picture a great composer in an airless room.
Mm. So there is this all-star cast, Eric, which, you know, the guys used some studio musician, Steve Gadd, who played on like a gazillion records as a drummer, but also jazz giants like Wayne Shorter playing saxophone, which all of which sort of tilted this album a little bit away from rock, or some people would say a lot away from rock, and into something that was in this netherworld between pop and jazz. How did this album sort of go over with jazz fans?
Well, I think it was a natural bridge for people who liked jazz and maybe didn't like rock so much to get more into what was on the rock charts at the time. I will say, you know, I'm a musician. I've been a drummer for 30 years, a vocalist and bass player. And I find the idea that a band has worked hard to create great musical performances, to have that belittled and have that say that that's too slick, I think doesn't make any sense. You know, these guys are trying to get the best musical performances out of the guys that they're working with, and that doesn't necessarily translate to a lack of passion. And again, you know, if you listen, I mean, you listen to Asia, you've played some of the other stuff, it's not as dense as the Grand Illusion or Boston or those big rock albums of the 70s. You know, it still sounds like a band. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes people are reviewing the band's image instead of the actual music. Because, you know, it kind of blows my mind to say that the Grand Illusion would have more emotion than a song like Home at Last or a song like Josie
Black
Cow.
What is the band's image?
Well, I think the band's image is one of two perfect performances. They had this reputation for making great players like Steve Gadd do just tons and tons of takes of songs until they finally got it right. They would have different collections of musicians come in and play songs, and often the musicians themselves didn't know what tunes they were on until the record came out. The guys would have people play stuff a ton of times, and then they would come in and redo it themselves. You know, they were known for being perfectionists in the studio, and that worked for them for a long time. But at some point, it did start to get bloated, and I would say the record after this one, Gaucho, is where that started to happen, and where the creativity of their compositions failed to match the creativity of their musicianship.
Right,
and that's when you got into problems. And one more thing, Steely Dan, I also think their message was sort of the futility of life and the emptiness of modern life sometimes, particularly the emptiness of modern urban life. So if you hear their compositions and you feel like it's lacking passion, what they're really doing is they're trying to talk about that ennui that we feel in urban settings a lot.
Mm.
And so again, I think sometimes people are mistaking, you know, a very deliberate sort of choice
let's give Alex a chance to jump back in here, Eric.
Yeah.
Alex, you feeling the ennui?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, and I'm definitely not opposed to ennui at all. I mean, I look at the music of that era that is the stuff that really resonates with me is things like Richard Hell and the Voidoids and Television's Marquee Moon and, you know, things like that, or even, you know, hell, the first Motorhead album. Those all came out at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And I would never, I don't want to misrepresent myself as characterizing this as a passionless album. This is obviously perhaps one of the most consciously put together pop albums there is.
Well, and you know, when the Coldplay record the Coldplay album came out a few years ago, a lot of critics were sort of saying the same thing. It's too perfect, every note in exactly the right place.
It was funny.
What's wrong with that?
Well,
there isn't anything wrong with that. There isn't anything wrong with that. And it's, but what it happens for me is that I listen to this music and I understand that the performances are perfect and everything is in the right place, but it almost feels, you know, it feels like I'm in a really well-tended store. Mm. Like, you know, in fact, that's what I associate Steely Dan with, is being at like Bed Bath and Beyond or something like that, because that's where you hear it. And
okay,
you
know, in aisle three, we have Peg. Let's give a listen to some of the album Asia that we're discussing in the Soundcheck Smackdown this week from Steely Dan. I keep it with your letter. Gone up in blueprint. It sure looks good on you. And when you smile for the camera, I know I love you better. One of a string of hits off the album Asia, the 1977 record by Steely Dan. Steely Dan, the work of Donald Fagen and Walter Becker, and the many, many studio musicians they brought in and out of the studio to make this album, which has now been entered into the Library of Congress's National Recording Registry, one of the 25 albums chosen last year. What do you think? Let's check in with some of our Soundcheck listeners. Julia's on the line with us here in Manhattan. Julia, did the Library of Congress make the right call?
Yes, absolutely. You know, I personally can't stand it, but I understand the significance and the importance of Asia and mm-hmm. of Steely Dan.
So, but you don't like the record yourself?
No, it's unsettling. There's something about the tonality, and it's very clean and it's unsettling. And I think that sort of captures 1977.
Hmm.
You know, that feeling of like...
Not the clean part, not if you were in New York back then.
Exactly, and I was. And it's kind of like, maybe we can all make it like this and it will be okay. You know, there's something like very sort of post-apocalyptic about it.
Hmm.
And just kind of like, I keep listening to lyrics because, you know, I also shop in Bed Bath & Beyond, and I keep thinking there's something that I'm missing, but really there isn't. And I think that's the tricky thing about it.
Hmm. All right. Yeah. Well, Julia doesn't like the record but sees the value of the Library of Congress decision to induct it into the National Recording Registry. Mike is on the line with us from Huntington. Mike, what's your view?
Well, I can't say that the Library of Congress made the right choice. I mean, I don't. Were they looking for a Steely Dan record or something to epitomize what 1977 was about? But I was in high school at the time and a big Steely Dan fan. I just remember when that album came out, me and my friends listening to them, like, what the heck is this? We just did not like it at all. It was too poppy, too clean. It represented a lot of what was going on, so maybe that's why they chose the record. But that record and of bands like Styx and so forth, that's the kind of stuff that pushed me to discover the really cool stuff that, in my opinion, was going on at that time. It was just coming on, like Talking Heads and, mm-hmm. and The Clash and Elvis Costello and Joe Jackson. That just brought me in a whole other direction as far as music is concerned.
But up until that point, you had been a Steely Dan fan.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm still a big Steely Dan fan, but just not a big fan of that record at all.
Okay.
Some of the stuff kind of grew on me, but I just tried to like it. I remember it being played everywhere when it came out when I was in high school. I'm like, no, just
yeah,
not doing
it was
for me.
It was pretty ubiquitous. You're right, Mike. Let's hear what Peter has to say. He's joining us on the line from New Jersey. Peter, Steely Dan's Asia. Go.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Couldn't resist calling. I guess I'm the burnout in the corner that wants to take you outside. I think a lot of people are missing the point. The last caller did hit on one of what was going to be one of my corrections, is that the music was clean. It wasn't slick. You could argue there's a certain amount of production value in it, you know, but it's not some glossy, high-tech production number like you'd have today. It was, you know, certainly handpicked musical artisans that were just, you know, the tops in their field, you know, put them together, and naturally what's going to come out is going to sound, you know, perhaps what some would call a bit too perfect.
Mm-hmm.
But people who say, I don't know how you could say there's bloat. There can't be any bloat anywhere in any of their songs. I mean, it was a very clean, very pure type of sound, you know, and that might not be what you want to listen to all the time. It's not what every band should sound like, but that was their thing, and there certainly was no bloat that
okay.
I could hear ever.
Well, Peter, thanks for the call. Let me throw it back to you, Alex. You know, we've sort of avoided the term soft rock so far, but was this album in some ways kind of a gateway drug to lead? I mean, it led one of our callers to the emerging punk scene, but could it have led people to, you know, the LITE, the light radio format as well?
Oh, I think so. And I think, you know, I think a lot of the things that they did on this record, and whether they did it, you know, ironically, that's the one word that always comes up with Steely Dan that we haven't talked about yet is irony. I think one of the things that in there is that they were taking these kind of diffident ideas, these ideas of ennui, and they were putting it in the most, I guess, maybe easily digestible package possible. Even taking, you know, like some of the performers they took, you know, that Wayne Shorter plays that solo on the title track. And, you know, I listen to that, and that sounds like a, you know, progenitor or maybe like a, I don't know, for light jazz, which is, you know, I mean, I guess there's nothing wrong with it, but I don't think there's maybe not that much right with it either.
Are you saying that you hear something sort of calculated in this record?
Very much so. I mean, mm-hmm. I think that, you know, I mentioned to one of my editors once, we were talking about music, and Steely Dan came up, as it seems to always do around me, and I said that, you know, I didn't care for him. And he said it was the album, you know, this album was the one that made him want to go listen to jazz. And I countered, like, this is the album that made me not want to go listen to jazz. And it really wasn't until I went back to things like Bitches Brew and things like that Wayne Shorter, you know.
That you realized there was more to Wayne Shorter than that solo in Asia and the title track.
And that was the kind of stuff that made me really want to go back and explore jazz when I heard that.
I can hear that Eric has taken his gloves off.
Well, I just wanted to say two things, which is, number one, I think, again, people are blaming Steely Dan for what came after them. And for what people did with the pioneering spirit and some of the sound and some of the juxtapositions that they put out there. And, you know, Chuck Mangione and Maynard Ferguson, and, you know, you can say what you want to say about those guys, but they were all great musicians. They all did great work. And the smooth jazz that came after them, we can all agree, was not so great. But you got to recognize what the musicians did and not blame them for the stuff that followed. And I also sense a division between people who like their sound a little rougher, who like music that is a little less perfect, and people who like music that stays in between the lines. And that's different than saying that that what Steely Dan did doesn't have artistic value. I can listen to something and say that's not my preference, but artistically I can see something's going on there.
As again, one of our other listeners did.
Yeah, and yeah. So again, I think people are kind of, you know, I can dig Television, I can dig Talking Heads, I can dig all that stuff. I like a lot of that stuff too. But that's a totally different vibe than what Steely Dan was shooting for and what they achieved.
All right, I want to get
It's almost like judging a great basketball game by whether or not it was a good football game.
Sure.
All right, I want to get one more caller in. Andy joining us from Jersey City. Andy, are you a fan of Steely Dan and of Asia in particular?
Very much.
Why?
Well, I was going to say that I think that I read Walter Becker saying that they were kind of almost stealth punks, that their worldview was the same as some of the punks in many ways, and just that they used a slicker and a more subversive, through the slickness was a sort of a stealth way of getting their message across.
Well, okay. So Walter Becker, one of the two central figures of Steely Dan, along with Donald Fagen. I'm going to give the last word to Seth Rogen, who in the film Knocked Up has his character say this line: "If I ever listen to Steely Dan, I want you to slice my head off with an Al Jarreau LP." it's a great line. I'm not quite sure what it means, but Eric Deggans has been with us from the St. Petersburg Times in St. Petersburg, Florida. Alex V. Cook on the line with us from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. He is a music critic and music editor for OutsideLeft.com. Eric, Alex, thank you guys both for being with us on our Soundcheck Smackdown this week.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Still to come, a song you didn't hear when the Tuareg Desert Blues Band Tanarawin played on Soundcheck. But first, a favorite on-air moment from this year. We'll hear about love, life, and law enforcement when we revisit our session with the freewheeling musician Todd Snyder. This is Soundcheck. Come on.